All right, welcome to Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. I'm Phil McKenzie.
I'm Michael Brooks.
On Point is where we highlight someone getting it right. And I'm really excited because we have a longstanding friend, a riding partner. I've been at many of her parties, less than on my best behavior. And we are joined by Ms. Katie Longmire. What's up, girl? How are you?
What's up? I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Now, you rep Good Peoples, and you are indeed good people. So why don't we just start with you giving all of our listeners a sense of, you know, what Good Peoples is all about?
Wow. Well, Good Peoples started as sort of an accident. I was at a club sitting next to a bunch of really good friends, and everybody I was sitting next to was a creative. So everyone had a skill that was a little different than the person sitting next to them. And we sort of organically found each other and were spending time together. And I said, why are we not doing what we're doing right now together and making money off of it? So we all pitched in and threw a party, and that party sort of put us on the map. It was for a magazine that no longer is in print, but it was called Beautiful Decay Magazine, which was sort of a high art and then flash graffiti magazine. And every different person came to the table. Like, one person was a DJ, another person was working for LRG and got them to sponsor. Another person came to the table with a venue. I packaged it all together and promoted it, and it took off. So that evolved, and more people wanted to collaborate and do parties, and it was always sort of a platform of collaboration and partnership. So that turned into sort of a strategic partnership platform that's rooted in nightlife and music and creative output, so to speak.
Nightlife and music are some of our favorite things. You know, when you're starting to talk about that idea of collaboration, one of the things we talk about a lot on the show is this idea that, you know, things that are fresh, that are going to push the boundaries, come from the margins, so to speak. Do you feel like that's sort of baked into the way you guys collaborate, that you're all coming from these different environments that are somewhat maybe marginal relative to how people think of mainstream?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I see in mainstream is with stuff that started as marginal, right? So what we see is sort of the ground floor of what everybody else sees. So what you see as mass consumer absorbed now is something that I probably saw a couple years ago in a nightclub. And it's not new to me anymore. So we're, you know, sort of leaders of the new school. We are the ones who are, you know, creating those fashion trends, making those beats that are weaving their way into Jay-Z and Kanye tracks. You know, people like Hudson Mohawk's a really good example. He was a kid in art school in the UK, and then he was making beats in his bedroom. He posted them, got picked up by a really small label. That label blew up, and then he was making beats for Kanye. So, like, you know, by the time he's making beats for Kanye, everyone's like, oh, there's this whole genre of music, left field beats, there's this whole thing. And people had maybe caught the wave right before that, but he played in a dive bar in Brooklyn at a music festival that I own long before that. And, you know, now that would be unheard of. So it's a fun moment of creatives, and creatives push boundaries, right? They're people who are always thirsty for something new and something different. So they're always creating something. And when they come together, the more of them that come together, the louder that gets. And then it gets a groundswell and it gets pushed out to more and more and more people.
How, taking us back even a little bit further before we even get to like the Good People piece, which you've just explained perfectly, what was it that put you in the place in the business and in the art world? And you describe yourself as a business artist, in fact, where you were sort of finding the link between those margins that we're talking about and then the kind of like broader culture, labels, companies. When did you kind of discover that instinct for finding those connection points yourself as an artist and as a scout?
I think it sort of happened to me. I think I'm an artist first. Mm-hmm. I often use the term business artist. I think that most people have a medium that other people are more familiar with. So I don't use paint, or I don't design clothes. I'm not a fashion stylist. But what I can do is put ideas together in a creative way and then build concepts together, which I still think is a creative execution. Or if I build an event, I think about all the different parts of an event. Now people use the big word experiential, but like, mm-hmm. to me, mm-hmm. it's literally all of the moments about, like, you know, who who's in the room, what they're doing, how they're doing it, et cetera, et cetera. So I think for me, like, I grew up kind of like, I played the cello. I was like an orchestra kid. I was a stage crew kid. I was, you know, I felt different than everybody else. I had an amazing community, but I was always pushed to go find other people. And I went into nightclubs really young. I was promoting nightclubs by 16 because I loved dance music and I loved how different it was. And I loved being in the city and being in these crazy environments and discovering music. That was when like Tower Records was a thing, and you would go and dig through the dance music section and listen to all of the music and see what you liked. And I discovered house music that way, and some of the DJs I still love that way. And I found a whole community that way. And it just sort of organically connected me to a whole community of artists and people and things. And as I got older and older, I was, you know, I went into the music industry first. I worked at Warner Brothers Records for 7 years, and I worked in the brand partnerships department. So that was my first, I was an assistant, but I was my first exposure to the fact that you could match music with a brand and make something, anything. And I think that was a traditional approach. And then I found myself in a non-traditional environment. So I took what I learned into my environment and started building things, my own event properties and that kind of stuff.
Two quick sort of two-part question. How did you find yourself in that non-traditional environment? Like, what was the transition there? And then when you talk about getting like the right people in the room, finding those balances, finding those different voices and sort of ways of doing things that you want to bring together, is there also like the other part of that on the business side? Is it also like finding the labels, finding the platforms, finding the partnerships, finding the brands, finding the whatever? You know, it's another thing that Phil and I talk about a lot, which is, you know, letting culture simmer so that like when brands are looking to partner up or finding new ways of doing things with new artists or new sort of means of expression, that they don't sort of like crowd it out. They allow the artists to kind of maintain their creative focus and independence. So I guess the shorter question is, where did you get to the transition to the non-traditional environment? And then on the flip, how do you sort of gauge the business side when you're matching them up with the artists in terms of allowing them to, you know, maintain their sort of vision and ability?
I never really let go of the non-traditional, so I started there, right? So I was working in nightclubs from 16 all the way through college. I got a full-time job, but I never really satisfied my, you know, creative expertise. It satisfied my sort of like mental stimulation and future learning and career growth, but I always wanted to go out. So I basically lived a double life and never slept. So I would, right. You know, I would like go to work all day and go out all night.
Yeah.
I was luckily like, you know, I was a kid and I could do that. And so that's sort of how that happened, and it never stopped. So what happened was, as I grew more and more into like my business self, I also grew more and more into the community that I loved. And I started growing into learning how to take my skill. You know, I didn't want to just sit in the club. I wanted to do something with the club. Like I used to always say, I was like, I don't want to sit in the VIP booth. I want to be the person who walks behind the VIP booth and make sure that you're good, you know? So that's sort of how I ended up in that role. And then like that role itself is sort of like an orchestration of people, places, and things. You know, you're creating conditions for people to manifest whatever energy you want to create in the room. And that's where you get connected with creatives, because you'll, like, I'm usually the person who's drawn to like the quietest person in the room or the weirdest person in the room, because usually they have the most interesting thing to contribute.
Meet and super producer Matt Leck. Boom.
There you go.
Yeah.
You know, I'm kind of the person who would corner you and talk to you all night. You know, like that's just what I do. And people will be like, what are you doing? I'm like, yo, this person's dope. And that's sort of where I sort of start and pull from. And everything sort of evolves out of that. So what happened with Warner Brothers is, you know, the music industry became what it was. I was there for the end of the Fabulous days, the beginning of the transition. Like I was working at Warner Brothers when iTunes began. Like the conversations about like if you were going to sell a single song or a record and why that was important, and all the artists who fell all kinds of ways. I got to watch all that happen. And then, you know, they were having a moment where they were thinking about their identity, and I looked into my other community, and my other community had already figured it out. And so I wanted to put all my resources where my heart was, and I did that.
It sounds like, you know, even though people might look at all these things and focus on a few of the key words that we've talked about so far. There's nightlife, there's clubs. People think of that promoter hat, but there's a lot more to this, particularly when you start bringing in brands and corporate relationships that go far beyond the idea of promoting a singular event. It definitely does sound like what you are creating is an experience that transcends even what the brand might want to do, because it's very authentic.
Yeah, I mean, I don't consider myself a promoter. I usually joke around and say that when people ask me what I do and I don't want to have a conversation with them, I tell them I'm a promoter, because it just ends the conversation. You know, give them a very clear, you know, in the box idea of who I am and what I do. If you say I'm a nightclub promoter and you are me, you look like what I look like and do what I do, people are like, I get it. You know, that's not what I think of what I do. I think of myself as a producer. I think of myself as an experiential creative. I think of myself as a businesswoman. I think of myself as a cultivator. And I think that that's what attracts brands. And, you know, like, brands come to us. We don't go to them. So many people come to me and ask me to sell sponsorship for them, and I always say no. I do not do that. I don't particularly have any interest in doing that. Mm-hmm. I want to work with people who identify really clearly the value of the community and what they're doing. And so what I do is I build what I consider to be incredibly valuable platforms that can house repeated identities of creative ideas or even one-off experiences for people that are dope, and then make enough noise around them, which is the promoter hat that I wear for that part of it. But like, I make enough noise around them where someone is interested in investing and contributing because it benefits them to be part of what's actually happening.
Now, this is also, because we should emphasize, you know, we talk about a lot about New York, and that's a topic I'll never get tired of. And I don't want to be too nostalgic, but when you bring up things like Tower Records and that idea of actually being, you know, touching things tangibly and going through old record bins, like, I do want to touch on that a little bit, but I want to emphasize that, you know, a lot of the work that you do is indeed global. So when did you take that on as part of, you know, this can move beyond a New York or even United States situation and become something that touches other countries, other cultures, and those sorts of distinctions?
I think that for me, New York's a global city. It's not a national city. You know, someone was always like, oh, when you know you're doing the best thing in the world. And I was like, when you're in New York, it's the best city in the world. Everybody from all over the world usually passes through New York, especially when you're in like a culture or music or lifestyle space. So one of the cool things about constantly hosting and creating experiences is those people always pass through my doors. So I have the privilege of being there to receive them. And if you're really open to it, they will come to you and they show up and you get to know them. And then what I found is there's a community like mine in every city around the world. And all you have to do is send a couple emails and be like, hey, I'm going to insert city here. Who are you people there? So like, I went to Hong Kong once, sent that email out. And then that first night I was there, there was a friend, now a very dear friend, who literally on the strength of a mutual friend picked me up, took me out all night. All of the friends I made in that 3-day to 5-day window are still my friends to this day. Working at places like ad agencies, Hypebeast, owning restaurants, teaching yoga globally. And now I have an entire network that in one phone call I can call and tap in and build something with them. And they want to do it too, right? Like, they want to come here and do something and I want to go there and do something. So now we have a trusted network. And so it was never really like, I think when you think about ideas, global sounds like it's big and scary. But when you build an idea, you build it the same way, right? The building blocks of doing something, whether it's for one person or for 50 people, are the same fundamental building blocks. The same thing goes with a different country. You still are building it the same way. You just have to wrap your head around the fact that, you know, it's the same distance on a flight to Portland or San Francisco that it is to Paris. What's the difference? You just land in a much different place.
I'd rather be in Paris. Though Portland's cool too, but I, you know, if I had to pick right now, I'd be heading east.
Yeah, fair. I mean,
much spring in Paris right now. I'd like to be there.
Yeah.
I'd like to be in Atlanta. 80 degrees. I haven't forgotten that. Do you think that, as you know, another thing that we're kind of hitting on a lot, which I loved how you just explained the sort of like your global community is by definition, like it's at a human scale because you're building it on this like really direct and organic level and building it around these kind of natural relationships and kind of communities that make sense. Do you think that in the environment we're in, that more and more people are kind of understanding, maybe even like more and more viscerally, that, you know, success, for lack of a better word, or ability to really put your work out there doesn't just rely on, you know, how big your kind of like notoriety can be or how much energy you can get on different social platforms, but on really basically like building the relationships you're talking about, which is a deeper level than just those interactions. Like if you're, you know, Instagram, Snapchat, whatever life reflects what's actually happening in terms of the range of your relationships, range of things you're doing and how kind of deep your community is, then that's cool because that's a reflection. But if you're using those things to kind of substitute for those actual relationships, then that's where we sort of like run into those problems and things not actually sort of happening potentially. So I'm just wondering, like, do you think that people are getting that kind of more and more, like the importance of really taking the time to invest in all of those relationships, whether they're on your, you know, your same block or internationally?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm a true victim of my socials not reflecting my real life. You know, I don't think anybody
fully does. Of course not. That's a high bar. So don't take the question at that high a level.
I mean, that's not something that I ever was really good at. I always have a lot of the people that I work with and I'll just hand them my phone and I'm like, can you, you know, figure this out? It just stresses me out.
That's relationships right there. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I can't post on five things at the same time and try to write good copy. I'm not a copywriter. It's just not my thing.
Right.
So like, I'm more like, I use my socials more to give people a lens into what I'm doing. Cause I think I end up in really unique situations and then I get to see things from a perspective that most people don't. Mm-hmm. So like I can be behind the DJ when there's 80,000 people in front of them. Right. That's a dope picture to me,
definitely.
You know? So like, I use it for that. But I always came up in the relationship space where you're only as good as the relationships you have, and the deeper they are, the more beneficial they are. And so that's my come from. So like, if I meet someone and I want to have a relationship with them, I usually joke around that I keep somebody once I've met them and I like them, I keep them.
Mm.
And like, so I just keep them as I go along the way, and I invest time in that and I invest effort in that, and I, you know, build trust with them. And because of that, I think they know that they can trust me. I think your reputation and what you deliver is really important. So like when I say I'm going to do something, I do it. I don't say I can do something I can't do. But you know, honesty, trust, all that kind of stuff is like a really big part of my network. And I think that's what makes it as strong as it is. And, you know, I think that, you know, the internet can make everything feel familiar, but as soon as you step out into the world, you might recognize somebody, but until you go up and talk to them, that's not real.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, a lot of the things you're talking about, these ideas of trust and honesty, even though they sound very simple, many of them are the golden rules, you know, that we all think about. You know, they're things that are not practiced all that often. So,
but there's a reason they became golden rules.
Yeah.
Like,
but we
got to
reclaim them. Did you?
Yeah.
Like, I think it's actually refreshing to hear that, because I think a lot of these worlds are often what I would call like zero sum games, meaning that if someone's going to win, another person has to lose, and people are very guarded about their relationships, their resources, whatever it may be. And it seems like you found actually going in the opposite direction has helped.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't call it the opposite direction. I feel like that was the only direction that was ever sort of presented to me. Like, my parents are a generation older than everyone else's parents. So I always often joke around. I was like, I grew up in the Mad Men house, literally. You know, like, you pick up the phone and you're like, this is the Longmire residence. I'm sorry, we're eating dinner. You can't talk on the phone right now. You know, I have two Southern, very deep parents from the Deep South, and they hold very traditional values. And that carried with me. You know, I think that like people think that if you are using the word like hustling, which I do use, or like grinding really hard to be successful, that you have to do it at the expense of another person. But I think one of the best pieces of advice I was ever given was that if you have something good, share it with everybody, because everyone will share back. and you all win together. So like, if you're the leader of the person of all the group sharing, you're going to always be the leader and everyone's going to continue to lift you up. And it's not about taking, it's about giving away.
That's perfect.
Yeah, that's a perfect place for me to leave it.
I yeah, can't leave me. It there because I want to ask one more
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, go.
A few, we got well, not a few more things, but
go.
I wanted to.
I just like that. That see that to me that was poignant.
It's so zen and poignant.
I'm so I'm always on that, you know, production design. I'm like, wait, that's gonna leave. There's someone stepping out of their subway ride right now, and they just got a little glow on their face and they're ready to move. But all right, hit them with more brilliance.
I know. Well, I ruined their movement because you mentioned very early on like your music festival, and I mean, you're involved in so much, and I always want to make sure in that interest of like sharing and when we bring guests on, we do bring them on because we care about the work that they're doing and we want to use this time to shine a light on them. And I feel like you went over very quickly, your passion about music, and particularly like you mentioned in passing, oh, the music festival I own, like tell us about the music festival.
So I'm the co-owner of the Brooklyn Electronic Music Festival. This next year will be our 10th year. It is a multi-dance music genre music festival, and we just in the past 2 years included panel discussions and additional programming, so like screenings and art viewings and things like that. It runs for 4 days the first week in November, and if you buy one ticket, you can go to every activity. So we take over every music venue we can in Williamsburg. So, you know, last year that was Output Verboten, which is no longer, it's Shemansky's now, but Music Hall of Williamsburg. At the time, Public Assembly was there. Brooklyn Bowl. So like, there's like, you know, in a very concentrated small group of blocks, there's like a ton of music venues. And so we take them all over. And you can buy one ticket and hop around every night. So one room might be like trap, another room might be house music, another room might be techno. During the day, you might see a live stream panel discussion from the Vice office. And it's our way of sort of infusing the community from the inside out. So we don't book EDM music at all. We usually go for more fringe artists, but we'll put them on the same stage as a huge, huge artist. And so people will go and buy a ticket for the huge artist and end up seeing a fringe artist they've never heard of before. We've imported parties that were famous in the UK and other parts of the world and like had them pop up over the weekend. We've had really well-known nightlife photographers that are like similar to our, you know, nightlife photographer personalities in New York. We've had them come and join us and do photo stories with magazines. We try to really touch every part of what makes our community what it is. And it, you know, it's not about just going to one show, although you can do that. You can buy a ticket to an individual show. It's about exploring. And then when you explore, you're walking through the streets of Brooklyn and then you see all these other people and they're also walking through the streets of Brooklyn and you're all wearing the same wristband and you realize there's a community there. So it sort of forces awareness of what it's like to be there and the connectivity you can have around music and exploration.
See, I had to give that time and I feel good about that now because see how you passed over that and it's like 10 years running, almost 10 years running, a super significant
never
event.
Never ending font, man.
You know, and it's Brooklyn and I'm from Brooklyn. I always got to find a way to rep everything that's hot that's going on in Brooklyn.
Is there any people who went to Howard that are involved with that by any chance?
I mean, I lived a block away from Howard when I was in D.C.
All right, there you go.
Like,
see, there it is.
I'm just trying to hit all Phil's marks here. I'm trying to hit all Phil's marks.
Katie, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. We got to do this live. We
can't
wait. We can't wait to the rooftop because I'm going to be at the rooftop again this summer. I'm assuming you're having
awesome.
It.
Oh, this is the rooftop that I always kept missing?
This is the rooftop you kept missing.
All right,
I'm telling you.
I'm there.
Yeah, you're missing
I'm there.
Out. It's like
I know.
The roof
I'm
every
there.
Friday from Memorial Day to Labor Day. 3 p.m. to 9 p.m.
All right, it's on.
See, I'm an evangelical for your joints.
Yes.
Like straight up and down, I'd be like, yo, this is the best party.
All right,
Friday,
first one.
Rooftop, leave
first
work
one.
Early, come to this joint. It's
first
dope
one.
As hell.
I always tell people to like come and have your meeting on the roof. I'll save you a table. You can look all fresh. I haven't called it, you know, just meet me on the roof of the standard. We'll watch the sunset and I'll buy you a cocktail. And like, you'll never leave. It'll be that good.
Perfect. That is true.
I'm with it. Okay. I will definitely be seeing you soon.
Katie,
awesome.
Be well. Enjoy the 80 degrees. See you back in New York and see you on the rooftop.
Thanks, Katie.
Thank you guys so much.
And that's On Point.